You're listening to KNON 89.3 FM in Dallas, Texas. Stay tuned for Frank Zappa. Frank?
Yep.
Hi, Frank. This is Pete calling from Dallas here in KNON. How's everything in California?
How you doing, Pete? Everything's fine here.
Doing very well. I want to just start out by saying how really pleased I am to get you on the air tonight. We're a big fan of your music out here and have loved you for a long, long time, so we really appreciate it.
All you have to do is talk up just a little bit louder and everything will be fine.
Okay, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to start off with a couple questions we got from out of the state. Some people called because you were your people out there were good enough to put the announcement on the hotline. We got a call from Jeff in New Jersey and wanted to know what it was like working with Don Pardo.
Don's a nice guy. You know, for years they kept him in that back room at NBC and nobody got a chance to see him. Because he used to do all the voiceovers on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And when we took him on stage with us in New York, he had been one of the funny parts of the show, but nobody had ever seen him. So he got to come out on stage. We put him in a white tuxedo, and he performed with us. And in one part of this song, I'm the Slime, he came out on stage and started dancing around in the tuxedo, so I urged him to go into the audience, you know, just to get out there with the kids, and he went out there and he made a circuit all the way through the Palladium. Mm. And finally he came back on stage and he was so excited because on the way back some girl had grabbed his weenie.
Yeah, that probably didn't happen to him too often, huh?
Yeah, well, you know how they are in New York.
That's true. He also wanted to know if Lather and Roxy and Elsewhere will ever be available on CD.
Roxy definitely, but the stuff that's in Lather is probably going to be released individually as Studio Tan, Sleep Dirt, and Orchestral Favorites, that kind of stuff.
So those will come out after you remix them and refinish them?
I've already prepared the masters for those things. We just have to schedule the release.
Oh, good. And I hope we'll see some of your own artwork, people who work for you doing the artwork, huh?
On those other covers?
Yeah.
Well, I'm probably just going to leave it at the same thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What about information as far as who is performing the tunes?
Well, I'll do what I can. A lot of that stuff, the paperwork on those albums has disappeared. I can, especially on Orchestral Favorites, it would be very difficult to get the complete list of all the people who are playing on it.
Yeah, a lot of people in those sessions, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, on the first mystery disc, you released a tune called Handsome Cabin Boy.
Yeah.
What is the origin of that?
It's a sea shanty.
Okay, and how did you get your interest in sea shanties?
In the early 60s, I used to listen to folk music, and some of my favorite kinds of folk music was sea shanties.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
Interesting.
That song was originally recorded by these two guys that made a lot of records of sea shanties, A.L. Lloyd and Ewan McCall. And there's two different melodies for that set of lyrics. There's another album that I found someplace else that had the same title, and the words were the same, but the tune was entirely different.
I see. It's a very interesting song. Who is Charlie's Enormous Mouth about?
Well, it's
can
not
it be
just
said on the air?
Yeah, well, it's not just the mouth, it's the nose in her case. It's a song about, girls who use cocaine and die from it.
Mm-hmm. Just as I thought. Very interesting tune. It should be used more often than anti-drug warfare.
Well, I wish, that's not the only anti-drug song that I've done. There's Cocaine Decisions.
Right? From Man from Utopia?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Those things never get played on the air.
Well, they will be tonight, so
good.
Don't you worry. A few years ago, Vince Neil from Motley Crue, driving drunk and killed somebody. Are you familiar with the story?
Yep.
Okay. And he served no jail time. Recently, James Brown was arrested after an interstate car chase involving PCP, and nobody was killed. He's serving a 6-year sentence. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, the comment falls under this basic category, and this is a comment that I've made many times before. This is a nation of laws. Badly written and randomly enforced.
Mm-hmm. And that's it, huh?
That's about it. I mean, just that's only one more example of things that you can see in the judicial system in this country that don't quite add up. I mean, that discrepancy shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody when you consider some of the other things that are still languishing in the courts.
Right. Do you feel it had any racial connotations to it?
Well, I think that there's probably a chance that there was a racial connotation in there. But the thing is, this doesn't mean that James Brown should get out of jail. I think it's more likely that Vince Neil should have served some time himself.
I agree. Yeah, well, manslaughter is definitely a serious crime. Moving right along, how did it happen that the early mothers were used in the movie Mondo Hollywood?
Because we had just come into Hollywood to work at that time, and the guy that took us on as the manager recommended that to broaden our musical horizons, we should perform in this film. We didn't know. We showed up to be the band playing at this party.
Yeah, well, it must have been interesting in those days to be making a movie, huh?
Well, working on Mondo Hollywood isn't exactly like working on
a movie.
E.T. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I guess that's true. Well, they might have looked at you guys as extraterrestrials, though, huh?
Well, not considering some of the people who were dancing in the room, I don't think so. I mean, you know, we were barely weird enough to be in the movie.
Okay. We got another long-distance phone call from John in Denver, Colorado, and he wanted to know, what would you do about Noriega?
What would I do about Noriega?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that kind of consultancy is not exactly what I'm good at.
Yeah.
I think that the real expert on what to do about Noriega is George Bush, since he hired him in the first place.
Right.
And it's hard for me to even imagine that I'm George Bush.
Well, let's hope that's real hard, yeah.
Since I'm not that wild about fishing, you know what I mean?
Okay. And he also wanted to know if you're moving to Switzerland?
Me? No.
Okay. I didn't think so. I don't know where that came from. Okay. Let's see. Okay, this is interesting. I was reading a review book, and I know you're real fond of critics. A man named Bart Testa describes mother people, and I quote him, as placing a cautiously rationalist humanism as something to which his fans might aspire. As his next albums would reveal, Zappa wasn't really the Dada nihilist of his public reputation, unquote. What do you make of this comment, and what were you trying to say with that song?
Well, it's hard for me to comment on the guy's comment.
Yeah.
He's expressing himself. I think that if I were going to make any criticism of his comment, I would say he's written in a very opaque way and the point doesn't come across very fast. I'm sure there's something in there, but I don't understand what it is.
Hmm. Yeah, I couldn't make heads or tails of it. What were you trying to say with Mother People?
At the time that song was done, and you probably don't even remember those days when people had long hair and looked different than the people who lived next door.
Yeah.
No, there was a certain type of discrimination that would occur to you if you look like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And basically, you think of the line in the song, do you think that my pants are too tight? Do you think that I'm creepy? You think, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just a song trying to get back at those people who would discriminate against any class of people who look different than them.
Was it any kind of call to get those people to join together, the people who look differently, and say, you know, we're here and it's
okay? Well, the people who look differently had already joined together.
Yeah, I guess that's
they didn't need me to tell them.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We spoke earlier about you coming out against drugs, and you've always opposed the use of drugs. With addiction being such a major problem today, what would you suggest be done in this situation?
Well, there's two ways to go about it. I mean, if you want to reduce the threat in the United States. The reason it's such a big business is because it makes a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And you can attack it from the financial level by increasing the scrutiny of those banks that have laundered the money and have greater punishment for the banks that have laundered the money. I mean, right now, if a bank gets caught laundering a few billion dollars for a cartel, they get a smack on the hand.
Huh.
And the other way is to I describe it as recontrolling it. It's not like legalizing the drugs, but it's putting them under the type of control that they have for liquor in some states. In California, for instance, if you want to buy liquor, you just go to a liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a private enterprise, whereas in other states, they have state stores where, you know, it's a controlled commodity. And if the federal government were to set up state stores that would control who could buy the drugs, and make them available, so that they were the salesperson rather than some guy in the jungle, I think that things would work out better,
mm-hmm.
because you figure it out. As far as I can tell, the United States government is already in some kind of a weird partnership with those guys in the jungle,
no
at
doubt.
Least with Noriega.
No doubt. Okay. We got a call from, I think this is my friend John, huh? Did he come?
John,
this,
yeah.
This is John here in Dallas. And he asks, why don't you release limited edits of old live shows? For all your fans who are big fans of the old mothers.
There's very little tape of the ancient mothers of invention.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
What were you running in those days? What kind of machine?
Well, the tape that exists of the mothers of invention between 68 and 69, because there's nothing before that.
Uh-huh.
We were recording either on a Ewer stereo 7.5 IPS portable recorder.
Right.
Or a couple of the dates, we used a Scully two-track that could record at 15 IPS.
Mm-hmm.
And on rare occasions prior to that, like I think there was a gig at the Whiskey A Go-Go in 68 where we rented a truck that had an 8-track machine in it. And then there was another concert that was recorded in London, 4-track. And there's two London concerts that were recorded 4-track. So that's about all the kind of tape that there is of that group.
Is that London show the predecessor to 200 Motels? Is that stuff?
Say again?
The London stuff, is that the original rehearsals of 200 Motels?
No.
No.
What I've got from I actually have the demo that we sent to United Artists for 200 Motels, and I'm thinking about releasing that.
Oh.
That was done in a studio.
That would be real neat to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Or to hear.
I've been working on an album called The Lost Episodes that has all unreleased studio takes from all different places.
Right.
And that's I put a version of it together that contained that. So that may eventually come out. But as far as limited edits of that old band, the only tape that I have that's usable will be worked into this series. You can't do that on stage anymore.
Okay. Okay. In a recent interview, this was just a couple months ago, you said Manny the Camper really wants to buy some white gas. And what did you mean by that?
White gas, that's what they call kerosene.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. So simple. So simple. I want to read so much other things into there. Huh? Who's singing that high vocal part at the end of that tune?
Davey Moore, who was the engineer on the session.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. What is the status of the underwear quilt mentioned on Tinseltown Rebellion?
The girl who put the quilt together displayed it and then donated it to an alternative station in Northern California, and they auctioned it off, so I have no idea where it is.
Oh, really? So somebody actually owns it then, huh?
Yep.
I'm sure they're real proud. Let's see. This came from a staff member of yours out there, Barking Pumpkin. He told me to tell you about this quote from Marshall McLuhan. It's the quote is, "If it works, it's obsolete," and he wanted to know what you had to say about that.
I've always been baffled by Marshall McLuhan. I saw some videotape or some film a couple of weeks ago. They were doing one of these roundups of the 60s, and you know, there he was spewing his philosophy, and I was scratching my head over it. It's another one of those people that if he has something to say, he chose the most obtuse way to say it.
No doubt. Well, he probably knew what he meant, I guess.
Well, let's hope so.
Okay, the song Let's Move to Cleveland had a couple other previous titles. Could you explain the origins of So Young and Mond and Kriga Bandolo?
Yeah, Young and Mond. Have you ever watched Ed Shaughnessy on The Tonight Show?
Sure.
Okay, well, you know he's got the medallion and the sideburns.
Right.
He's Mond. And Young and Mond is a person who is Mond before his time.
I see.
Okay.
Ahead of his time in Mondness. Then.
That's right.
I see.
And then Kriga Bandolo, well, did you ever read a Tarzan book?
I'm familiar with Burroughs, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what the natives always say.
Okay.
You know, Kriga Bandolo, white men come, fire sticks kill.
How'd that turn into an instrumental song? Is that the...
Well, the original title was Young and Mond.
Oh, okay.
And all we did was sing those words at the end of the song. We just got tired of singing Young and Mond, The Kriga Bandolo started at a concert in Orange in France. I just stuck that in there, and we did it that way for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided to make it even more variety on the 84 tour. Every time we got to that that part of the song, we would sing something else, and I would just whisper what we were going to do to Ike and Ray on stage right before the ending came, and we would just sing it.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, Let's Move to Cleveland just happens to be what we sang that night.
Uh-huh. And that's what you finally decided on is the title of the tune?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. In the We're Only For the Money insert, the cutout page,
yep.
Who is the lieutenant of school safety patrol?
His name is Gary Kellgren.
Huh? One of the engineers?
Yeah, well, he was, yeah, the engineer on We're Only In For the Money.
Okay, okay. Doing all the creepy whispering, right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. What, if anything, would you like to add to the book that you didn't write about?
Oh... that one's done. If I'm going to write anything else, it'll be in another book.
It'll be in another book.
Yeah.
So you said everything you wanted to say in all those essays?
Yeah.
Okay. This is interesting. This also came from one of your people out there in Pumpkin. At the premiere of Ravel's Bolero, the audience booed a man, booed the composition, and a man shouted, "The composer is crazy." And later on, Ravel said that this man knew what the song was about. That was his quote. What do you think he meant?
Well, I don't know. He was French, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, you figure it out.
Okay. And
well, here's another Ravel's Bolero story. I did an interview with the London Observer about a week ago,
mm-hmm.
And this, you know, they had the writer who came out here used to write for the British pop paper, so supposedly he knew something about music. And I played him this tape of our performance of Ravel's Bolero. He said, "That's really good." But you know what? He had never heard it before. He didn't know what it was.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was British. Will your performance ever see the light of day?
Yeah, it will.
Any of that?
Yeah, that's going to come out.
It will come out. Good. Because I know there was like talk of a 12-inch single or a 3-inch CD.
Yeah, well, see, here's the problem with it. In order to release it, because it's still under a copyright control that doesn't allow anybody to rearrange it,
mm-hmm.
except in England.
Mm.
The copyright has expired in England, and it's now public domain, so whichever way it comes out, it's going to have to be released to the company that has our deal in England.
Ah, okay. Okay. So that'll take some time then, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you familiar with an author named Ayn Rand?
I know who she is. Yeah, I've never read any of her books.
Never read any of it, huh?
No.
Okay. Because I've been reading some of it, and it seems you guys share a lot of similar views. Are you familiar with her philosophy at all?
Well, she was a libertarian.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Okay. Well, she called herself objectivism. That was what she called her philosophy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, objectivism, where her... Well, this was her basic theory, was that... I swear by my life and my love for it that I shall not live my life for the sake of another man, nor ask another to live for mine. Does that share any similarities with your view?
No.
Not at all.
No.
Okay.
That basically sounds pretty uncooperative to me.
Yeah. Well, it's a very rigid view, definitely.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that when a person who reads a philosophy book and comes across dogma like that,
mm-hmm.
and decides, oh yeah, that sounds good to me, and then sets out to live his life following a dogma, ultimately, you wind up being a Republican. You know what I mean? I mean, whether or not you vote Republican, you have that Republican mindset where nothing may change and I'm always right. That's what dogma is all about.
This is true.
You know, and that's, I think that dogma has gotten a lot of people into trouble and a lot of countries into trouble.
Yeah, and I think we live in one.
I believe that if you really want to live a successful life, flexibility is the key.
So you're more in line with... the slack theory then, huh?
Yeah, I think that you should always be prepared to cut your neighbor some slack.
Okay.
Especially if it's more practical, you know, even if you don't agree with him, you know, so long as what he's doing isn't going to harm you,
right.
What's the difference?
So acceptance is the key.
Yeah.
Huh, okay.
And practicality. I think that acceptance is practical.
I agree, definitely. How did you become interested in the synclavier?
Read about it in a magazine, and then I had somebody bring one over for a demonstration, and when I saw what it could do, I bought it. And I also hired the guy who demonstrated it.
And which was?
His name was Steve DeFuria.
Oh, okay. Okay. And what other computer-controlled instruments have you composed or recorded with?
Well, I have some other MIDI-driven boxes connected to the synclavier just to make some other sounds. But
any other controllers?
Well, I've got an octopad.
Okay.
Which you can use to enter drum parts just by beating on a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got three Roland devices, two Roland piano units, and this other Roland thing that I call the Foof Box.
What is a Foof Box?
Well, most of the sounds that are in there sound like they're going foof when they come out, so I call it a Foof Box. And then I have a rack of TX modules.
Oh, okay. Have you used any guitar synthesizers?
I bought the Synclavier guitar controller and tried to make it work, and it just doesn't work for me.
Doesn't respond to your style, huh?
No.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. Okay. Did you ever get any feedback from Bob Dylan after your parody of him in Flakes?
Well, he came over one day and asked me to produce an album for him.
Yeah, which record was that?
It was the one that Mark Knopfler wound up doing. I don't know what it was called.
Infidels?
I don't know.
Okay. How did that happen to come about?
He called the office for about 2 weeks, and nobody believed it was him. And then finally, one day, he just came over. He buzzed the gate, and here was Bob Dylan in my house. And he wanted to play me his new tunes and talk about doing an album. So I said, okay, let's go do it. And we scheduled everything to do it. And then he calls, and he says he needed a vacation. So he went off for a few weeks to the Caribbean, and I can't stop my life waiting for Bob Dylan to come over and make a record. I had to go on a tour.
Sure.
So we didn't do it.
Okay, that's interesting. I know there's a lot of books that have been written about you. I think that's one reason you decided to write your own book, to clear up some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In one book, they're talking about this story with this record, and you're quoted as saying that you told him to subcontract it to Giorgio Moroder and have him do a synthesizer track. Is there any truth to that at all?
Oh, well, what I recommended, he had a whole bunch of different types of songs, and I said that he would have a more interesting album if he would do each of the song in the style that it was, designed to be played in, and to use the types of musicians that were good for that kind of music. Like, if you're going to do something that's hard rock or something that's reggae or something that's more dance music, you want to use the tools that make it sound the right way.
Okay. Interesting. Was he a nice guy?
I don't know. He was only at my house for about an hour and a half, and the major event was my dog growled at him.
Is he a good judge of character?
Well, usually he growls at Christian, and I guess that was he was deceived, because at that point that he came over, he was back to being Jewish.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
Confused the dog, huh?
Yeah, baffled him.
Yeah. You worked with a guy named El Shankar?
Yep.
Who are the Dead Girls of London?
Well, you ever been there?
No.
One quick visit, you'll find
that. That's it, huh? That's all I need to know. Okay. And will any of your live performances of that song ever come out?
Yes, there's a version of it that's going to be on You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore.
Oh, good. Looking forward to it. What were you trying to say with the Thingfish story?
Basically, it's about two things. It's about the death of Broadway,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that AIDS was not a natural occurrence, that somebody manufactured it.
Uh-huh. And who do you think? Where does that lead?
What, who manufactured it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say the chances are that the source is American.
Mm. Some laboratory underneath Virginia, then, huh?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. When will the remaining tracks from the London Symphony Sessions be released on CD? There's a couple missing, isn't there?
Yeah, the problem with that is it doesn't fit neatly into one CD because of the length of the stuff. And we had, the only way to do it is the parts that are missing aren't long enough to put out as one whole CD. And the only real way to do it is to re-release it, equally dividing the time between two discs, and then some people would complain because they already had the first disc.
Ah, okay. We talked about a little bit about Studio Tan and Sleep Dirt, but do you remember who the musicians are on Gregory Peccary? Any of them?
Well, yeah. There's a lot of different ones. I think the total is 40.
Is that right?
Some of the people that are on there.
What's like the core?
The drummer's Chester Thompson, the keyboard's George Duke, percussion is Emil Richards, and Ruth is playing on part of it,
mm-hmm.
and Bruce Fowler is the trombone player,
mm-hmm.
and Earl Dunler is the oboe player,
hmm.
and after that, I'd really have to scratch my head.
Yeah, it goes on forever. There's a lot of stuff built into that
song.
Yeah,
and the conductor is Michael Zerot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And the main one of the main lead vocals, I guess, the very introductory vocal, is that you through a variable speed oscillator?
Yeah, I'm the narrator, Ann Gregory.
Okay.
And the secretaries are George Duke.
Okay. And what about Redunzel, musicians?
The bass player is a guy named Birdlegs Humans. The piano is George Duke. Drums are Chester Thompson. Ruth Underwood is percussion. And I'm the guitar.
Okay. And Birdlegs did the acoustic rhythm on Sleep Dirt as well, title track?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Very nice work, too. Let's see. In 1964, you wrote and produced a single for a band called Mr. Clean. Remember that?
It was 62.
62?
Yep.
Even longer. Who was in that band?
Well, the band is me on drums and guitar, and I think Paul Buff on piano.
Oh, really?
And the lead singer was a Marine who called himself Mr. Clean. Oh, and I'm playing the fuzz bass on it, too.
And did you get the story as to why he called himself Mr. Clean?
Well, he was a bald-headed Marine.
Oh,
Marine.
That's it?
Yep.
Okay. Let's see. With the 1990s quickly approaching, what do you see in the future for American democracy? We could do a whole interview on just this
subject.
Well,
that's an interesting thing, because one thing, if you follow today's trends, I think probably about the middle of the 90s, you can kiss democracy goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have a certain group of people in the United States that would like to see the whole idea of democracy phased out, and then you have the bulk of the voters in the United States who really don't, they don't give a damn. And they would be just, they wouldn't even miss it if it disappeared.
Hmm.
So,
a dying art then, huh?
Use it or lose it.
There you go. There you go. In the book's chapter 12, America Drinks and Goes Marching, you make some very interesting points. Could you elaborate at all on the beer theory?
Well, one of the things I say is we don't really know what's in beer. If you just take a look at the, you know, people in this country are fond of statistics and surveys. Take a look at the behavior of people who drink beer.
Yeah.
People who drink beer tend to do certain types of physical activities and social activities that people who don't drink beer are engaged in. And, you know, just like one day they discovered saccharin gives you cancer, maybe they'll find out one day that beer makes you weird.
I think it's already made plenty of people weird, huh?
Yep.
Yep. We got some more calls. This is from Tom here in Dallas, who wants to know, what would it take for you to run for public office, especially after your experiences with Tipper Gore and Congress?
Well, one thing's for sure, I ain't going to pay for it myself.
Yeah, I don't think there's that much money around these days.
Yeah, well, then I guess you won't have to worry about me running then, would you? Because I can't really see me going out shaking hands with people and say, hey, would you like to, you know, contribute to my campaign?
Right, kissing babies and stuff?
Well, I don't mind kissing babies, but the people who usually put money into campaigns are people who want favors in return, and I'm the wrong guy for that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we're glad you stand by what you say, Frank. Somebody needs to do that. See, Stephanie here in Dallas wants to know on Joe's Garage, and I guess she wants to know, oh, let's see, Joe's Garage, Cruiselets, and Why Does It Hurt When I Pee, Chunga's Revenge, The Clap, Road Ladies, was there some type of statement about sexually transmitted diseases that early?
Pretty clever there. Yes, that's all about sexually transmitted diseases.
Yes, indeed. Very good, Stephanie. And what was the genre of songs... Let's see. Was that genre of songs, does it have roots in the song Mud Shark?
No, because Mud Shark isn't about sexually transmitted disease.
No, it's more like about Buona Dick.
It's more about, you know, what certain people in a certain rock and roll band did with a girl and a fish.
Okay. Yeah, the chapter in the book, the one we've all been waiting for, that... I could read a whole book on that thing.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's why I call it the one you've been waiting
that's
for.
That's right, that's right. Okay. Inca Rhodes from One Size Fits All mentions the armadillo in our state capital, Austin, Texas. What happened there that made you mention it in the song?
We used to always enjoy playing there. you know, it's too bad it doesn't exist anymore.
Really too bad. There's not enough places like that around.
You know, what will they do, put a condo there?
Probably. I haven't been back there to look at it lately. Let's see. You were a disc jockey once at some college station. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
How did that happen?
Well, it happened by accident because they had what we would describe as a very loose security policy at the station.
Yeah.
And I would just walk into the station and go on the air. I wasn't a student there.
Daily? Just daily you'd walk
in? No, once a week. I got away with it for about 3 weeks before they caught me.
Unbelievable. And now on the mystery disc, there's an excerpt of you playing the piano, right?
Yeah, it was from the Uncle Frankie show.
Right. And what else did you play besides what we found on the mystery disc?
That was it. I would just, you know, piddle around the piano or play records or talk. It was a stupid show.
Do you remember
college
any
radio,
music?
You know.
You bet. Do you remember any music that you played? Records? What records you played?
Oh, I used to play, like, doo-wop records.
Oh, okay.
And that kind of stuff.
This was, like, what?
61.
Oh, really? It was that early? Okay. Is there any more of that available to be put out on mystery discs in the future?
No.
Or stage? That's it, huh?
That's about it.
Okay. What does GOA stand for from the guitar record?
Goa.
Yeah, Goa. Does it stand for anything?
Yeah, it's a type of, it's a region in India.
Oh. Okay. Have you been there?
No, but they have a certain type of food that I like.
Which is?
It's just, you know, it's a type of Indian food that's seasoned a certain way.
Huh. And Goa is the region in India where the food comes from? I see. An article in one of our local papers ran a story about you, and they mentioned some negotiations with the Leningrad Ballet.
Yeah, I met with the choreographer of the Leningrad Ballet. His name is Boris Afman.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to bring and this is like a modern ballet. It's not like the, you know, usually think of the Bolshoi doing Swan Lake.
Right.
They do weird stuff.
Yeah, well, we didn't figure you'd get involved with Swan Lake, Frank.
Well, you know, there's a time and a place for everything, but, you know, I'm not a Swan Lake kind of a guy. And he wants to bring his company to the United States, but if they come over here dancing to the stuff they normally dance to, he's afraid that maybe they wouldn't get the right attention. And even though he had never heard any of my music, he was interested in hearing a bunch of it to see whether or not he could choreograph it.
Hmm.
And, you know, I would help him bring his company to the United States.
And what's the status of that?
I don't know yet. I sent him the music, and last time I was there, I just missed him. I was in Moscow, and he came to Moscow, but he went back to Leningrad, so I didn't get a chance to talk with him. But I'll be following up on it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. What pieces have you sent him to listen to?
Oh, I sent him a complete collection.
Oh, really?
Stuff from the London Symphony album. I sent him Andy,
mm-hmm,
from One Size Fits All.
Great.
So all different kinds of stuff, because he'd never heard any of it, so I just put together a tape of all different variety.
Yeah, well, I like to see a dance interpretation of a thong rind. That would be interesting.
Well, I think that's probably the easiest way to interpret the thong rind. You know, a whole bunch of people out there with them.
There you go. Let's see, a couple more calls from Sam in Dallas wants to know why Lowell George left the Mothers and what albums did he play on?
He played on Burnt Weenie Sandwich and Weasels Rip My Flesh. And the reason he left the Mothers is that he was in the Mothers in 1969 and that whole band broke up. It's not like he quit the Mothers. As a matter of fact, when the band broke up, I helped him get his contract with Warner Brothers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So you were instrumental in the forming of Little Feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And remember, Roy Estrada was the bass player in Little Feet.
Sure. Let's see. You are what you is. General comment where you were coming from. Okay, there. Yeah. You are what you is, LP. General comment on where you were coming from.
I don't understand the question.
I don't either. I guess he wants to know what you were trying to say with the entire album.
Well, the two themes in the album, one of them is self-delusion, and the other one, remember the album was released, I think, in 1981.
Right.
The Reagan administration was about a year old.
Right.
And we were seeing the rise of all these television evangelists, and there's quite a lot of stuff in there about television evangelists.
Hmm. And in relation to You Are What You Is, how did you incorporate some of those songs into Thing Fish from Rick here in Dallas?
Well, because in order to tell the Thing Fish story, it seems that, you know, senseless to duplicate the effort and write another song about the same topic when Thing Fish was designed as a Broadway show.
Oh, okay.
And so I just took those songs from the You Are What You Is album and changed the lyrics, changed the arrangements a little bit, and put them into Thingfish. As a matter of fact, I've been negotiating with this guy for the last 2 years, almost 3 years, to put together an off-Broadway production of Thingfish.
Oh, really?
And I believe the contracts will be signed next week.
Is that right? That'll really come to be, huh?
Well, what the contracts are, gives him the right to, for a limited period of time, to go out and raise money to put it together.
Mm.
And, you know, if he manages to raise the money to do the show within the time frame of the contracts, then maybe you'll see it.
Wow.
And if not, then nothing lost.
There you go. Let's see, what was the easiest record to record?
The easiest record to record? Well, the guitar album.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All live?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how about the hardest?
Thingfish was very difficult, and so was You Are What You Is.
Okay.
Those many months on those projects.
Yeah, I imagine. A lot of parts in You Are What You Is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, my friend Logan wants to invite you to his birthday party. If you're in Dallas next week. Okay.
Yeah, I wish I could. You know how much I love birthday cake and all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
But, you know, in order to get there, you'd have to get on one of those airplanes, and those suckers fall apart.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. Wasn't 200 Motels the first commercial release shot on video and transferred to film?
It was the first feature film that was shot on videotape and transferred to 35mm. Prior to that time, there had been a couple other short projects,
mm-hmm.
you know, like concert projects that had been done that way. And the guy who pioneered that technique was the guy I hired to do 200 Motels.
Is that Palmer?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He did the Cream farewell concert.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting. And why was it that you transferred it to film?
Why did we transfer it to film?
Mm-hmm. Or why was it shot on video instead of film in the beginning?
Because most
of the
effects that are in there you couldn't even do on film.
Ah, okay. And let's see, if everyone thought like you, how would you think, or would you change your thinking? This is from Logan.
If everybody thought like me,
yeah.
How would I think?
Would you change the way you thought, I think is what he's trying to say here.
Well, I would try and remain flexible, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If everybody thought like me, it would be a very strange world.
That's true. Okay, let's see. What are the newest developments on the Porn Wars front?
Well, you have to take a broad perspective. It's not just whether or not somebody is going to change, clamp down the lyrics to rock and roll songs. I see a general trend coming from the extreme right-wing political thinkers in the United States to change this from a country which has always been a pro-choice country to a no-choice country.
Right.
And it's not just about whether or not you can buy the record that you want to buy or the videotape, but it goes into everything. The whole abortion business is coming from the same mentality that created all that stuff in 85 about the rock and roll lyrics.
Okay. And what do you have to say about Jesse Helms' art censorship issue?
Well, I'm not that wildly enthusiastic about the National Endowment for the Arts, and I'll tell you why. Because I don't think that if you have a government committee making decisions about who gets funded, it has to, just because you're dealing with that kind of mentality in Washington, it has to affect the type of art that gets made.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing about the National Endowment for the Arts is they have supplied money for regional orchestras, regional ballet companies, and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And I think that's good because it gives people, you know, outside of the major metropolitan areas a chance to have something that resembles culture in their own hometown. I don't have any qualms with that. But, first of all, the amount of money that we're talking about, it's so pitiful. I mean, it's compared to the rest of the government's budget, I don't see why they're even bothering with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't want anybody to think I was in Jesse Helms' side. He has no right to decide what's good or what's bad based on whether or not he thinks it's dirty. That's ignorance in action as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, the big stupid, right?
Yeah, the way big stupid.
The way big stupid. The same article in our paper mentions a composition you're being commissioned to write to commemorate the 500th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America. Can you tell us more about that?
No, that's not accurate reporting.
Oh, really?
No, the...
I'm not surprised.
I'll clarify it for you.
Okay.
In 1992 in Spain, there are three major things going on. They have the Olympics, they have the World's Fair, and they also have the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to Spain several times and negotiated with the World's Fair and with his Christopher Columbus Committee, and the idea was not for me to write a piece of music for them, but to put together something that I call the World Orchestra, which is an orchestra made out of ethnic instruments.
Hmm.
And then it would be up to these organizations to have commissions for 24 different composers to write music for this special orchestra, not just me.
I see. Wow, an interesting project.
Yeah, well, I won't know any more about that until about the middle of September, because everybody in Spain's on vacation.
The whole country, huh?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way it is in Italy and Spain in the hot part of the year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
A month-long siesta, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah. Apostrophe is soon to be released on the cassette, right?
Yep.
Yeah? And how did you come to use Jack Bruce on the title track?
Well, that was an accident. I was introduced to him by Jim Gordon, who used to be the drummer in the band in 1972.
Uh-huh.
We were in New York City, and Bruce was playing at Radio City Music Hall with Leslie West.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget who the drummer was.
Mm.
But after the show, since Jim knew him, we went over to his hotel and hung out with him for a while, and I had 2 days off in New York City in the middle of a tour. So I said, well, let's just rent Electric Lady Studios, you know, Hendrix's studio.
Right.
I booked that for a night, and we just went in there and had a jam session.
Huh.
And that's where that track came from.
Oh, is that right? So it was just a jam out of the studio, not intended for the record?
Well, I mixed it after we did the jam in the studio.
Okay.
Put it on the album.
Huh. Okay. In a recent speech, John Cage composed his speech of quotes from some of his favorite authors, including Marshall McLuhan and Buckminster Fuller. The quotes were pulled out at random and written down, and then Cage simply read them, and that was his speech. Now, I have done the same thing with my questions. I wrote them all down on cards, threw them in a bag, and I've just been pulling them out one at a time, which is why we've gone from topic to topic. So quickly, what are your thoughts on randomization?
Well, I think random... I use it quite a bit.
Yeah.
And the problem with it is that when you get done, the randomness itself is not any great positive value. It's whether or not by dealing with randomness at the end you come up with something that is a good piece.
Right.
And fortunately, with the machine that I'm working with, I can use random techniques and then edit the randomness into something that holds together.
Uh-huh.
This saves the audience a lot of time and trouble of trying to wend their way through the random parts that don't work.
Right. Okay. On In Gregory Peccary, there's mention of several radios tuned to different stations.
Yeah.
Is that a reference to Cage?
Well, not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that he did that imaginary landscape for radios and
right.
stuff like that. But that's not what's being talked about in Gregory Peccary.
Okay. Okay.
They're talking about real randomness.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and also a new release you got is the third volume of You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore. Is also coming out soon?
Yeah, we shipped the master tape off yesterday and the cover is being done.
Great. What unreleased material will we be getting on that one?
Oh, I would have to get out the log sheet and tell you what's on there. Let's see. There's another... The original version of Vicky's Such an Asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And one interesting thing, there is a fantastic drum solo by Terry Bozzio that was done in Tokyo, 1975,
mm-hmm.
followed by the original recording of Zootalores, the same concert. It's a live four-track recording. And there's a lot of good stuff in it, a lot of oddball things.
Well, good.
Very mix and match.
Well, we're looking forward to that. I'm really really liking these stage things because all that old material, for one time I thought it was gone and forgotten. We'd never see any of that stuff. I'm glad it's coming out.
It'll be out.
Good. good to hear it. What sort of work are you doing in international trade? We've been reading a lot about your new escapades in that.
Well, I can give you two little examples.
Okay.
One of them, which is already accomplished. I got a phone call from a guy in the San Fernando Valley who has a company that buys and sells amber. You know what that is?
Amber. It's a color.
Well, it's a gemstone, which is made out of petrified pine sap.
Okay.
And some of the best amber in the world comes from the Soviet Union, and he wanted me to find out how he could buy amber from the Soviet Union. And so I arranged it for him.
I see. And the other example?
The other example is there's a man who owns a company called Bake Enjoy Foods. And you've probably never heard of this company.
But no.
It's a large company that makes frozen batters for baked goods.
Okay. I heard you talk about it.
Okay. And I've located for him five different partners who want to do business with him in the Soviet Union. That are willing to buy his product and bring it in there and bake it and do all kinds of stuff. So that's being worked on this week.
So years later, you finally meet the Muffin Man, huh?
That's right. And his name is Gary Ogan.
Gary Ogan. Okay. Let's see. These are some more calls. Here's Bob here in Dallas. You had made a video for the song Inca Roads with lots of the fantastic claymation. How long did it take to make that? Was it part of a larger project? If so, what?
It's part of a larger project, and that project is being released on Honker Home Video very shortly. Cal Schenkel did the cover, and the cover art is sitting upstairs right now.
Oh, good.
The name of the videotape is The Amazing Mr. Bickford,
mm-hmm.
And it's 1 hour of clay animation.
Neat.
With music from the London Symphony Orchestra album and the Boulez album.
Okay. And how long did it take to make the video, Inca Roads?
Well, it took him about 8 years to do all the clay animation.
Yikes.
And the making the video probably took about 3 or 4 days just to edit it.
Okay. Let's see. From Jeff in National Park, New Jersey. Our Leather and Roxy Company... Oh, we already asked you this. He called earlier. Let's see. Are there cliff notes for your music? If so, so it is easier to understand. Michelle wants to know if there are cliff notes for your music.
Cliff notes?
I don't know.
That's like something from college.
Right? Yeah, right. It's a literary tool. Yeah.
No, we don't have those.
No, cliff notes. Okay. Let's see. And she says she wants those so she can appreciate the early Frank Zappa. Thank you, Michelle. Let's see. What was your favorite band to play with?
Oh, I don't know. I think the 88 band started off to be pretty fantastic, but then it wound up as a disaster.
Yeah? What happened?
There was a little war that broke out between the bass player and everybody else in the band.
Uh-huh.
And so they all swore they would never go on stage with him again. That's why that band broke up.
Oh, and that's why you didn't make it to Dallas.
That's right.
Yeah, because I remember it was booked.
Even though we had all these offers for gigs during the summertime, we couldn't take them because by the end of the European tour in June... In order for me to replace anybody in the band who didn't want to be on stage with a bass player, I'd have to go back into rehearsal again. And that band rehearsed for 4 months.
Is that right? Yeah, so that's too much time to waste. Yeah. Yeah.
Too much money.
Yeah, this is for sure. I heard a story about this bass player, and maybe you can tell me if this is true or not, that one reason the rest of the band didn't want to play with him is he was adding an extra 16th to every measure. Is there any validity to this?
Well, they had a number of different complaints about him. They were complaining that they didn't like his notes.
Mm.
They didn't like his bass notes.
Mm.
And they claimed that he was not holding up his end of the band and, want this and that and the other thing. But they really just didn't like his personality. I mean, everybody makes mistakes on stage, playing, especially when you're playing songs that are this complicated. Nobody plays 100% perfect on every show.
Right.
In fact, nobody even plays 100% perfect on one show. So I think that their complaints were not well-founded.
Right.
I mean, if I thought he was really a bad musician, I would have fired him.
Yeah, because he had been in the band for quite a while.
Right.
Yeah. And most of the people playing with him had been playing with him for a while, too. Isn't that right?
Yep.
So all these things just all, they fell at once.
Yeah. Well, let's be honest about it, though. Scott Tunis does have a unique personality, it's a
yeah.
getting along with him requires a little concentration. But then again, everybody in the band has got their own idiosyncrasies, and those kinds of things are going to happen no matter what kind of band you have.
Right.
But when you get a really big band and you get that many complaints, you've got a big trouble.
Okay. Our phone lines are kind of slowing down. Let me give out the phone number for you folks to call up and ask Frank questions. The number is 823-7490. We've got Frank for a little while longer, so please give us a call. Let's see. Also in regards to playing with different musicians, who would you like to record with that you never have, including the past and the present?
Oh, I don't really have much urge to record with live musicians.
No?
No.
Okay. So it's going to be mostly... Well, this leads to my next question. When can we expect some new Simple Veer recording?
Hopefully by the end of the year.
Yeah? Is the Lumpy Gravy Phase 3 in progress?
Yeah, that'll be the one.
Yeah. We're looking forward to that for sure. Let's see. If you had a direct line to Mr. Bush, what would your advice be on handling the Middle East hostage situation?
Well, you know, I wouldn't want to give you a quick answer to something like that. I would be happy to tackle that as a question, but by the time I sat here and really considered it, you know, the show would be over.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot to that one for sure. Okay, whatever became of the case involving the zoning ordinance restricting home studios in Los Angeles?
I haven't heard anything more about it since the last time I did an interview on the topic. I haven't heard one more squeak out of those guys.
Oh, good. So maybe they've given up?
I don't know.
Okay.
No news is good news.
There you go. I've always been amused by the titles you've chosen for your instrumental pieces. Can you tell me where the inspirations for Damp Ankles came from?
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
Oh, good.
Okay, there's this guy named Steve Seadian who used to be an art director at Hustler.
Uh-huh.
And Steve is a truly unique individual. This is one of those truly one-of-a-kind type guys. And before he went to work for Larry Flint, he worked as an orderly in a mental institution.
Mm.
And his job, I mean, this is going to sound like a science fiction story, but you want to know about Damp Ankles? Here it is.
Okay.
His job, he was like the scoutmaster in the Pinhead Hut. And the Pinheads liked him. And he had to, you know, like, stay overnight in the Pinhead Hut.
Uh-huh.
And they would express their appreciation by licking his ankles. And so he had to start wearing these muffs on his ankles.
Oh, God.
You like that one?
Yeah, that's a good story. That's a
so
very good
when,
story.
Next time you listen to Damp Ankles, just picture what's really going on there.
That's a good image to have for the tune. Okay. And what about who was Falconelli?
Did you ever read a book called Morning of the Magicians?
Mm-mm, no.
Well, read that book and then you'll know
okay.
What it's about.
That's a good story. Okay. And Black Napkins?
Well, Black Napkins commemorates this one tour. We're in Milwaukee.
My hometown.
And it's Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And while everybody else is having a real Thanksgiving dinner, we're in a rock and roll band, and we got to eat Thanksgiving dinner in a hotel.
Right.
And we go down, you know, most of the guys in the band got together, went downstairs to the dining room, and go in and sit down, and it was really a lousy meal, and to top it all off, they had black napkins. That'll cheer you right up on Thanksgiving.
You bet. Okay. And sofa number one?
Well, that's from a larger piece that we used to perform in 1969 and 70 with that band with Mark and Howard.
Oh, okay, like Once Upon a Time is part
of
that?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was just taken out of context for One Size Fits All?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What is a Mendocino Beano, Frank?
Well, Mendocino is a place where they have a mental institution in California.
Mm-hmm.
So a Beano would be like your head.
Okay, Florentine Pogan, how could the she in Florentine Pogan be the daughter of a cookie?
How could you be the daughter of a cookie?
Yeah.
Well, why does it have to be a cookie?
It doesn't have to be, but there is a Florentine Pogan. It's
of
a cookie.
Of course there is a Florentine Pogan
but
cookie.
Who is yours? Who is your Florentine Pogan then?
But the multiple intention there is this. Florentine also means a person who is from a town in Italy called Florence.
Ah.
Okay.
Okay.
And
Who knows what the word pogan really is? You know what I mean? Does it really mean cookie? Or does it mean somebody who pogues? So she could be the daughter of a wealthy person from Florence who pokes.
Okay. Okay. That's probably about as close as we can get, I guess, huh? Mm. On the radio, anyway. Yeah. Let's see. These are some more calls. I don't know who this is from. Are you pleased with the kids? Any advice for them?
Am I pleased with my kids?
Yeah, what an understatement for an answer. I mean, you have to...
I think they turned out really, really good. Yeah. They're still turning out, actually.
Yeah, this is true. And doing very well.
Amit, the one who is 14, just turned 15.
And as big as a tree?
Yeah, bigger than a tree.
Bigger than a tree.
I'm so proud of him because he got a job in this television show called Circus of the Stars.
Oh, boy.
Now, it sounds really stupid, but he wanted to be in the circus, and he went down there and he tried out for this thing. And they took him, and every night he has to go down there and train to be a clown and do all this stuff on the trampoline, and he's learning this routine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's great. Now I can tell people, I got a son. He's a clown. He's in the circus.
He's in the circus. There you go. What's Dweezil involved with?
Dweezil and Moon have this television show for CBS, which starts taping in about a month.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Variety show?
It's a sitcom.
Oh, really? Interesting. Let's see. Any more Zappa? Oh, no, any more Zappa concerts, I guess, is the question here. And I think we know the answer to that one.
Yeah. The answer is no.
Right. Okay. Give us a... what? A quote on... Oh, something about William Bennett?
I don't like William Bennett. Okay. I think he's a stuffed shirt, and I think that he's, you know, to me, he's like really a bad leftover from the Reagan administration. He's an ideologue. He's one of these kind of guys that, like, says all this really tough-sounding stuff that probably won't work. You know, he's just, to me, he's the wrong guy for that job. Mm-hmm. I didn't like him when he was the boss of education. I mean, take a look at what he accomplished in that position.
Right.
Did our schools get any better during the last 8 years?
Nope.
Okay, well, then what do you think? How's he going to be a drug czar?
This is true. This is true. He obviously isn't the man for the job.
I don't think he's a man for any kind of a job outside of just spewing dogma and ideology for the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. You know, he's a good salesman for that. They all love him. They think he sounds... we'll stick him in a boot camp. You know, why don't you say concentration camp, Bill?
There you go. There you go. Well, I think a lot of these people operate on the theory is what they don't know won't hurt them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just hurts everybody else if they get in a job, get in a position to do the job.
Right. Let's see. Have you listened to Jack Bruce lately? Any of his new material?
No.
Okay. Poetry by Ishmael Reed. Are you familiar with him?
Nope.
Okay, let's see. I can't read this. Okay, are you sold on digital? And any problems that analog... Any problems you encounter that make analog better?
Any problems that I've encountered that would make analog better?
Any problems with digital that would make
you
use analog?
Well, there are a lot of problems with digital. I mean, it's a very fussy medium to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But... One of the things that I really disliked about recording in analog was there just seemed to be no way that you could get rid of the tape hiss and still have some kind of clear top end on your tape. And although some people complain about the way the high end sounds on digital recordings, I would rather have that deficiency than have hiss lurking in the background.
Yeah, okay. Well, my random thing really worked out very well because we're right up at the top of the hour and I have pulled my last card out of the bag. So as far as random, hey, it worked tonight.
It worked perfectly.
There you go. Is the title of Jezebel Boy a reference to the biblical character or the Betty Davis movie?
Neither.
Neither? What's it about? Well, we know what it's about, but where did the title come from?
Well, have you ever been to Los Angeles?
Yes.
You know this part that they call Boys Town?
Yes.
Okay. If you ride up and down that street, it is crawling with male prostitutes. And every time you have one of these news reports like the police department is clamping down on prostitution in Hollywood, they always round up the women. They never round up the boys. Never. It's very strange. It makes you wonder, you know, like maybe there's some guys at City Hall that like those guys down there. And that's what it's about. Jezebel Boys.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, Frank, once again, I really want to say thank you very much for being with us this evening. Oh, one more here from my friend Dave. Plastic Ono Mother's Jam from 71. How did that come about? The scumbag, I guess.
Well, I was introduced in the afternoon before the show to John Lennon by a guy who wrote for the Village Voice.
Uh-huh.
And I invited him to come on stage with us that night, and they did. And we just happened to be recording the Fillmore East album at that time. We had a recording truck already plugged into the stage, so
okay.
That's how the tape was made.
Nice guy, John?
What?
Was he a nice guy, John?
Yeah, he's a very nice guy.
Good, good. Okay, well, Frank, again, thank you very much. I hope we can do this again some other time. Did you have a good time?
I had a great time. Well, I like this rant. We can randomize it again one time.
Okay, Frank. Well, listen, have a nice day out there, or I guess evening in California,
yeah.
And we will be in touch.
Okay, see ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.